believers. And what we have been looking at so far is how to overcome defilements and talking about the different ways of dealing with certain types of defilements that are still real and also sensuality. And I'm going to continue with a similar kind of theme. The next theme is really more about impermanence and how to use the idea of impermanence to kind of help the spiritual practice, the spiritual practice, and separate ourselves as part of the spiritual practice. And one of the nice things about impermanence is one of the three characteristics of existence, impermanence, suffering, and oneself. And in a sense, if you focus on impermanence, you bring in the other two characteristics of existence at the same time. Because if you understand what impermanence is all about, then the idea of suffering kind of comes out from that. Something is impermanent, it is by nature problematic. Also, the idea that if something is impermanent, the idea of non-self also kind of arises out of that. These things are very closely connected to each other. So by focusing on impermanence, you're kind of drawn together many threads in one go. And in some way, I think the idea of impermanence is quite intuitive. It's quite easy to understand. Yeah, at least we understand it partially. You have understood it in all its depth and all its breadth, etc. At least it's quite easy to have a partial understanding of this. Not self, much more difficult to fully grasp what that means. Suffering, also not so easy, because many of the things we consider happy in our lives, but I say that it's suffering. But actually turns out, if you're very careful, it turns out to be suffering. Sometimes it is deceptive, because even impermanence actually can be quite hard to see fully, because at least the superficial part of it is very easy. So how do we contemplate impermanence? And we have already seen quite a few ways already on how to do that. Many of the things I've been talking about have been about contemplating impermanence. We're talking about the sensual objects of the world, how impermanent and unreliable it is. So already we have seen quite a few ways of doing this. But there is a few standard ways in the suttas how the Buddha talks about impermanence. And one of the typical ways you always see the Buddha says the five aggregates, the five elements are impermanent, they are suffering, they are not self. This is something as a theme that you see going throughout the suttas everywhere. Five aggregates are impermanent. What is the five aggregate? Well, as I mentioned before, the five aggregate is just experience. It just means that experience in all its forms is impermanent. So actually, it is a very broad thing, and it doesn't really focus down very clearly on anything in particular. So one way of looking at this is to see impermanence through your meditation practice. This is why if you go to a Vipassana retreat, that's what they will talk about it a lot, that you are seeing impermanence as part of your meditation experience. And I want to show you how the suttas talk about this later on, in terms of watching the breath. How do we watch the breath and then have insight into impermanence as part of the watching of the breath? Because, as I said, watching the breath itself takes you all the way to the end of the path, but watching the breath is the complete fulfillment of all the factors of meditation practice, metaphor, Satipatthana, applications of mindfulness, all of that is fulfilled by watching the breath. So impermanence also is the right there. So have a look at that tomorrow when we get to the Anapana Sutta. So if you're thinking about leaving tonight, think again, because tomorrow we get the glorious Anapana Sutta, And it's really, actually Anapana Sutta is a very beautiful and very powerful. But this day, if you have any chance, even if you'd like it, that's what the Anapana Sutta is. So we'll look at that. And one of the interesting things that comes out of Anapana Sutta, which we can hear a slight preview, is that impermanence has many different bits to it. There is like a superficial impermanence, seeing things kind of rising and changing all the time. And then there's the more profound impermanence, when you see things disappearing completely. These are different things. And I don't think people make enough out of this kind of this distinction in how to see impermanence. There's changeability. Changeability itself is quite superficial. When things really disappear, impermanence is kind of becoming very profound. And that is a massive importance in meditation practice. So that is in meditation itself, but in permanence, you don't actually just have, it's not just a matter of meditation practice, you can also reflect on impermanence, yeah? If you are on a meditation retreat, you sit a lot for many hours, you become peaceful and calm and all these kind of things, then sometimes you need to do something else than just watching your breath, or watching the soles of your feet, touching the ground. And sometimes reflection on the Dhamma, on certain things, can actually be very powerful. And this is one of the things that the Buddha actually talks about quite a bit in the suttas, different ways of regarding impermanence and the matter of this reflecting. And this next sutta, the Arahata Sutta, is a bit like that. It's more than that. I'll have a look at that in a second. Another thing is about just thinking about the world. Thinking about the impermanence of the world outside. How things are always changing, how things are so unreliable, how you cannot control the world. And one of the great sutras of them, which I think is very quite interesting for a couple of different reasons, is what the Buddha talks about more like really big picture impermanence, like the sun, and the sun engulfing the earth, burning up the earth. It goes through a number of stages of the sun kind of expanding. It doesn't say expanding, it says heating up. And eventually it becomes so hot that it burns up the earth. And then he says that when the sun burns up the earth, there's nothing left, there's no ashes or anything like that, it's all completely gone, and it's kind of disappeared. And it's interesting first of all, it's obviously interesting because it shows impermanence in a very kind of, in a very broad, large scale. You can even expand that, you can see that the whole universe, the big bangs and these kind of things. So it is about large scale impermanence. Obviously the earth is, everything is incinerated, nothing is left, that is kind of, you can't hold on to this mind very much. So that is an interesting way of looking at it. But what is also kind of fascinating about that sutta is this whole idea that the Buddha talks about the sun getting hotter and hotter until it burns up the earth. But it's kind of astonishing, it's kind of, what is that doing in the sutras? Well, how did this one idea even fit in there? Is it just an accident? Or is it just kind of somebody thought about this for some accidental reason? Or is it that the Buddha has some kind of insight into how the universe works? It's not obvious how the Buddha would have known something like that. That's kind of also kind of weird. It's a bit of a sidetrack, but it's kind of weird anyway. And sometimes you see this thing in the suttas where it kind of gives you this feeling that the Buddha had a view about the world, which is quite remarkable, considering that this was 2,500 years ago, and they had basically there was no astronomy, science was very primitive in those days, it was more about speculation, all this kind of things. But somehow these things are in there. And sometimes you have this feeling that the Buddha was somebody who, he was quite exceptional in some ways. He was an ordinary person in one way, but in other ways he was also quite astonishing how somebody could know about these things. But the point is not that, whatever powers the Buddha had, maybe recalling past lives or whatever, that's kind of irrelevant. He says, in fact, he says towards the end of the sutra that, all of that is really, the way he puts it, it's all really quite irrelevant. But the point of this is just to point out impermanence. This is not impermanence, it's radical. Everything has to go. The sun will expand, the earth will burn up, there will be no ashes left, nothing will be left, and it's all going to be gone. It's just a particular way of reflecting on the idea of impermanence. There's nothing to hold on to. Absolutely nothing. Human civilization, everything we have ever done on this planet, everything will be absolutely gone. You will have no history then. Sometimes you hear people say the meaning of life, or kind of, we die and then there is nothing kind of left, but at least we leave a legacy, We leave a legacy to the next generation. We bring up our kids in a good way, and they will remember us, they will come to our grave when we are dead, and they will come to the flowers on our grave. Should I? Yes, maybe for a generation or two that will happen, and then you will be completely gone. And even if you are super duper famous, like the Buddha is pretty super duper famous. 2,500 years later, we say, well, not the Buddha. It won't be that long before the Buddha also is completely disappeared into the mist of history, the clouds of history. Nothing will be left, nothing will be there anymore. And in one way, it's sovereign. There is no such thing. In the end, there is no legacy. In the end, there is no history. In the end, everything will be completely blown away. nothing will be there, everything will be absolutely wrong. And the ego doesn't really like that. The ego would like to kind of be more, to to have a bit more of that history and legacy things going on. Otherwise, it all seems a bit empty and pointless. But that is the point. Pointlessness is the point, yeah? So once you start to see this in this large scale impermanence, this is one way of thinking about it, and it's perfectly valid. Yeah, perfectly valid way of thinking about it. So any way you can think about impermanence, so basically it's happening. So that is the meditation impermanence, seeing it in meditation, seeing it in a large scale, how the world works. So. And then there is a third way of thinking about impermanence. It's not actually called that in the sutras, but that's actually what it obviously means. And that is the death contemplation. And death contemplation is actually a very powerful impermanence contemplation, because everything has to go. Everything comes to an end. You can't hold on to anything yet. And you start to understand why death, very often, is a time of suffering, precisely because of the impermanence that comes. There's a time of suffering here. It's also a insight into non-self. All these things, you have to let them go, you can't take them with you, and it's non-self as well. So all the three characteristics come into the death experience as well. So for this reason, this is one of the reasons, one of many reasons, why death contemplation is actually very useful. And I would recommend every one of you to do some death contemplation. Maybe even on a regular basis, nothing very morose, nothing so if you feel depressed or sad, but just enough to remind you what is important in life. And I was thinking maybe tonight, maybe we can do a bit of death contemplation and meditation about it, if you're interested in that. If you don't feel comfortable with that, you don't have to take part in it. You just want to break or whatever. But if you, it's actually not very scary at all, it's just kind of exactly quite nice. If it works, it's really quite nice. So it's, I'm going to give that a shot and see what happens. So these are different ways of thinking about impermanence. And if any one of these ways are perfectly acceptable, I'm going to have a look a little bit more at these ways and later on. But now let's just have a start over a brief look. The sutra is a very simple sutra. There isn't much to say about it, really. But instead, it is quite nice and it's only one way. It's just one way of thinking about impermanence. Arada Sutra, page 11. In the past, there was a teacher named Araka, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. And one without lust or desire for sensual pleasures means someone who is the samadhi effect. That's kind of the short one way of saying somebody who attains jhana. Yeah? He's kind of a spiritual sect. But this is outside when there's no Buddhism. That's why he's a founder of a spiritual sect, where there's no Buddhist teaching around it. At that time, the highest is normally considered to be the ascetic who practices jhana, practices samadhi, is considered the highest at that time. He was a founder of a spiritual sect, he was a leader of a spiritual sect, basically. The teacher Araka had many hundreds of disciples to whom he taught the Dhamma, such as this. Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So here we had hundreds of disciples that taught the Dhamma. In India at that time, the word Dhamma just meant the teaching. Yeah? So he had a teaching such as this. Brahmins. Brahmins is not just an honorary title for spiritual seekers. Anyone who is a kind of sincere spiritual seeker, especially those who are practicing well and attaining jhana, whatever, we call them Brahmins. It's an honorific, doesn't mean necessarily that the word means Brahmins, but means that it's an honorific for a spiritual seeker. Short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and much misery. Yeah, this idea that short is life is, I think, one of those very useful contemplations. And see how fast it goes. Before you know it, it's over. Before you know it, you're on your deathbed. And you're thinking back, what was that then? And it's a very useful contemplation. Because it arrives on the point that now is the opportunity Don't take the opportunity now, it may never come back. So you should wisely understand this, and the consequences of understanding that is that you lead a spiritual life, yeah? You live it, you do what is wholesome and lead a spiritual life, but when none were born and escaped death. This is one of those great consequences of death complications, in that you become a more wholesome person. It's by living much better, it's a kind of the purpose of the death complication in the end. There's a nice sutta which I often read out, at the very end of the sutta, this is about death contemplation in particular. And it says that if you are a monastic and you contemplate death properly, you will never disrobe it. Yeah, it's because you forget about these and the anarchies of life, and it's often why you end up disrobing. And so these have a very settling effect. It brings you into the present moment. It reminds you what is important, that the future is so uncertain. If you disrobe, what are you disrobing for? You're disrobing for this vast uncertainty. You have no idea what's going to happen. Instead, you focus on the present moment. Now is a chance to practice life and do what is correct. So, as you can see here, the idea is that the death contemplation is a very powerful contemplation when it is done as a life life. So then we get these seven similes, yeah? Or the sutras are full of similes, and these are the seven similes about the length of the human lifespan. Just as a drop of dew on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and will not last long. So you realize human life is like a drop of dew. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. For none who are born can escape death. This idea drives home the limitedness of human life. Yeah? How short it is, how unreliable it is. How uncertain it is, and even while you're living it, still there are enough problems to cause you much suffering and much misery. This is an important part of this idea of death contemplation, to remind yourself of how short it is. And not only is it short, not only does it come to a halt very quickly, but you never know when it's going to come to a halt. That's kind of the scary part of it. It may suddenly, one day, bang, finish it, and it's all over again. And of course, we all expect to somehow live to be at 70. I don't know how long people expect to be at 70, and at 80, if you're kind of lucky or whatever in there. Some people live longer than that. You sort of have that expectation, but actually, it is quite unrealistic. You just don't know how long it's going to go on for. This is one of those great things that awakens the sense of urgency in you when you realize how uncertain it is. And it's very useful to remember this. It's so easy to read a story in the newspapers when people die. You see the stories all the time, right? And sometimes you read about young people dying, and everyone is so sad, that's so unfair. The young life was kind of taken away. Yes, was it unfair? Maybe not. Maybe that's just life, yeah. Sometimes young people die. Sometimes middle-aged people die. Sometimes babies die. Most of the time, old people die. But actually, it is not that certain. Life is not against nature that young people die. It's just that nature is kind of more heavily leaning towards old people dying, but it's also perfectly in accord with nature that young people die. And this is a story that Adam Rama was telling when he goes to funeral service. And actually, it's a very nice story, especially when someone young has died. It's a story that we tell every time. And it kind of drives home the point that this is not against nature, actually, it is part of nature. This is a story you've probably heard it before, but I'm looking anyway, at least some of you probably have. This is a story of this monk who was living in a hut in the north of Thailand somewhere. I don't know if this is a made-up story or a real story, but I can imagine. But this is a story of a monk living in this hut. Yeah, a weird monk, ghost monk, who knows anyway. It was a monk sitting in this hut. These huts you have in the middle of the jungle are often very simply built, because they're built by the villagers, yeah? They're built very simply, you only stay there for a while and you kind of move on. So maybe built on stilts, it has a grass roof very often, and it's very quite fragile, it doesn't take that much to kind of knock it over. He was living in this hut, and one evening, as he was kind of settling in for the night, a storm kind of comes, yeah? This massive storm. And And during the night, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And at one point during the night, that's what it's here, the trees around him falling down, branches being broken off the trees, coming crashing down to the forest floor. It's a massive wind coming through them. Yeah, and then he thinks, I may die tonight, this is so uncertain, and all these trees coming down, one of those trees hit my cootie, I'm toast, I'm finished, that's it. Kind of gets you kind of going, yeah? Either you kind of just become really afraid, or you kind of get your practice coming, I don't know if you want to. But then nothing happened, and he's okay, and then in the morning he comes out, and he has a kind of survey of the land around him. And the forest door is thick with leaves, yeah, because some of the leaves have been torn off the trees. And then he has a look at those leaves in the forest door, and most of the leaves that have fallen off are the older leaves, the brown ones, the grey ones, the ones that were about to come off anyway. Yeah, that's what you would expect. But then among those leaves, there are also some younger leaves, some mature leaves, and some younger leaves, and even some baby leaves that have been torn off the tree. Yeah, it is according to nature that when a strong wind comes through, and the older ones will go for the most part, but kills some of the young ones. And then he looks up into the tree, looks up in the canopy above him. And of course, most of the leaves that remain, they are leaves that are young. The young leaves are most of the ones that remain. But among the young leaves, there are still a few brown leaves clinging on, yeah? Clinging on to life. These are the old people who have, I don't know, maybe they just come out and live very healthily or whatever, still holding on to life, even though some of the very youngest ones, the babies, have passed away. And it just reminds us that life is like this. This is the nature of life. There's nothing has gone wrong when a baby dies. Nothing has actually happened. And yet we often think that it's unfair and it's unreasonable. No, it is not really unfair and unreasonable. It's just the nature of things. In one sense, you know, if a very small child dies, it is not really, you know, when you think about it rationally from a Buddhist point of view, it is not really bad or good as such. A small child hasn't had much time to make much bad karma, yeah? So in that sense, it's okay. They die and they probably get reborn again as a human being somewhere else, because they haven't had any chance anyway to do many bad things. So that's the good thing about it. So in that sense, it's kind of a neutral thing when a small child dies. It's not really hard to be too sad about it. And the reason we get sad, of course, is often because of our own suffering, not so much because of the child itself. This is just a way of looking at this, of reminding ourselves of the idea of death, yeah? And it can happen at any time. It's not just those people in the newspaper. It's very easy to make it a foreign thing. Oh, a child has died in the newspaper, or someone of my age has died, yeah? But it's them, it's not me, yeah? It's someone else. No, actually, this is just the nature of things. It could be you as well. And the Buddha says in the Sutta, he says that we should always, you know, one of the ways of doing this is to remind ourselves of all the way that we could die at any time. Yeah, when you kind of go down the stairway next time, maybe you're unlucky, maybe you fall. It's kind of that stairway, it's like the stair that all kind of really solid, or you know, that really kind of quite capable to fall on that stairway. Yeah, if you look at the tiles and all that stuff, it's all very hard, very rough. You really hurt yourself if you fall there. It's so easy; you can die so easily. It can happen at any time. You know, you step into the streets, you have some illness that is going on right now, you stumble somewhere, just fall over, bang, and you are finished as a consequence. A meteor comes out of the sky, bang, it hits you. That's pretty unlikely. But it happens sometimes. You get lightning, bang, and you're finished. So this is the uncertainty of life. It is very unreliable. So, what does that do? What does that do to us when we kind of take this on board? Yeah? I could be dead. Later on today. I really could be dead. It's not just a fantasy. Actually, it could really be the case. I could be dead later on today. What does that do? And what it does, the powerful thing about this, you know, you have like a dewdrop, a battle rag, a fan like that. What it does is it takes away so much of the nonsense in life, so much of the silliness, so much of the pettiness and the smallness in life. And this is part of the very big part of the problem. Not as a reason why we get irritated and upset and angry with people around us. All this is technically the things. But if you are going to die in an hour, how angry are you going to get with the people around you? How many arguments are you going to get into? How many kind of harsh debates are you going to have with anyone? In fact, it's a cancer. People are going to do any of that. Yeah, you're just going to be equanimous and at ease and maybe kind to people if you know you're going to die in an hour or half an hour. Yeah. How much desire are you going to have for the world you think if you're going to die in an hour? Yeah, how many things are you going to even think about your next relationship if you are going to die in an hour? You're not going to think about all the worldly things and all the worldly problems because they become irrelevant. Yeah. Your next time, it doesn't matter anymore if you're going to die in an hour. So all of that drops away. Even your next meal doesn't matter if you're going to die in an hour. So what it does, and this is the power of all the contemplation of death, that it takes away so many of the departments of the mind. It drops away. It becomes irrelevant because this world, you are leaving this world. Almost all the departments we have, they relate to this world in one way or another. It is all gone. So if you are able to think about death in the right way, it actually purifies the mind. It makes you ready for meditation practice. And this is why death contemplation, combined with ordinary meditation practice, can be so powerful. I'm going to die in an hour. What does that do? It means that everything just drops away. Everything is irrelevant. Everything doesn't matter anymore. You become peaceful and still. I have seen that myself. Sometimes I see people who are just about close to dying. And if someone is quite still, and they have maybe been a Buddhist before, and they have learned to let go, they have lived a good life, especially if you have lived a good life. Good life leads to a good death. You live a good life. Usually you're able to be peaceful, you become peaceful when you're about to die. Why do people become peaceful when they are about to die if they have lived a good life? Because if you have lived a good life, you are able to let go. And because you're coming close to death, you realize, I have no choice, I have to let go. So you just automatically you let go. And when you let go, you become peaceful. No more desires, no more anger, because you are there, finish with this world there. And move on to somewhere else. You're not going to take that with you. But instead of waiting till our death, bring that perception into the present moment. Use it now. Yeah, precisely because it is so powerful. So because we know this is likely to happen when we die, take the opportunity, bring it now into the present moment. Imagine you are on the deathbed. In one way, we are all on our deathbed. Yeah, we're always on our deathbed because we know it's coming. There's not a single doubt about that. So imagine yourself on the deathbed. I'm going to die. Heart attack. Yeah. Okay, it's been working. So you just don't know. And then when you make it reality, you really make it real. Like it actually has this powerful effect on the mind. It brings you back to reality. And then your defilements go. And this is the beautiful thing about death contemplation, is that ability to eradicate your defilements, to remind you, at the very least, of what are your priorities in life. Yeah? Sometimes when I think of my death, I don't have time to be upset with anyone. I don't have time to say anything back to anybody. Yeah. Who knows when this is going to come, what is going to happen? Every opportunity is an opportunity lost of being kind. There's never an opportunity to not be kind, or to be nasty, or to be unpleasant. Yeah, and this is kind of the thing that comes out of this. Every opportunity is so sacred, every opportunity to be kind needs to be taken, because otherwise you just don't know what's going to happen around the corner. So this is how the death contemplation can be used, and you can use it in many different ways. You can use it in your daily life. Every time you meet somebody, remind yourself, this could be the last time I meet this person. How do I want to leave them? Okay, you leave them in a good way. Yeah, and this is becomes then a powerful reflection in your life. What is interesting about the Buddha, he says that this death contemplation should be used by everyone. And it's something that we should make much of. We should do it again and again and again. Yeah? As you do that, it becomes a very powerful thing. It should be done by lay. Specifically, it says, this is one of the common phrases, I should be done by both by lay people and by monastics. So it is a very broad and universally applicable way of reflecting. So this is what's happening here when the Buddha talks about the dewdrop. Yeah? Bam, it's gone then. And there you are, it's happened. So, next one. Just as when thick drops of rain are pouring down water bubble will quickly vanish. It will not last long. So too, Brahman said, human life is like a water bubble. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life for none who are born and escape death. Just as a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish, it will not last long. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead a spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance, with a swift current carrying along much flotsam, will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl, flow forward. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One who wisely understand this, one should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can stay there. I really like this one here about the mountain stream. The answer is that human life is like a mountain stream, always rushing on, moving forward. Human life is about like this. A lot of people, all they do is just rushing around all the time, running, moving on, always on to something else. You know that? And when you ask them where they're going, oh, they have this goal, they have that goal. Well, did you have a goal last year? One year, but now the goal has changed. A new goal. I'm such an artist. Always new goals. But actually, the reality is there's only one goal in life. That is the cemetery. And it's the only goal. And you know that you're going to move to the cemetery. Okay. Now, that's a good reason for it. So we rush along, and we're kind of swirling on like this river, madly going downhill. But in the end, we're not actually going anywhere. We never reach those destinations that we think we're going to reach. We just end up in a cemetery, and we continue filling up the cemetery, mark up life. That is where what is all about. Buddhism is a ton of reason, isn't it? Cemeteries, dying, all this kind of stuff. It sounds very kind of, if you're not into this teaching, it must sound pretty terrible, but actually, of course, the whole purpose of these things is actually to improve the life. You start thinking about it in the right way, it actually improves life. There's a bit of short-term shock when you read the Buddhist teachings, but in the long run, it has a massive advantage. This is really, so that's kind of like waking up and seeing reality more clearly. So we stop running around so fast. That's kind of the result of this. And we may still do a lot of things, but our mind is no longer always in the future, no longer rushing on. We tend to become a bit more still and make all the swirling, all the things that happen in the world. That is kind of the benefits of this. Craving is what drives you forward. Craving is what drives us. Well, the speed isn't really driven by craving, but it's kind of, that's what it is. And of course, the flotsam is all the stuff that the river carries with it. Yeah, all the wood and things that kind of rips off the sides or whatever, the earth or whatever it is. And sometimes it's nice to kind of, life is a bit like that, because when we are driven forward by craving, always running towards the destination, very often there's a bit of collateral damage. Yeah? So they talk about a war, collateral damage. Oh yeah, a few thousand civilians die, that's what we have to expect in war. But collateral damage in our life is kind of secondary. Now you, because you are so focused on the goal, you don't see all the suffering that you create on the way. Yeah, is it that lack of compassion for the people around me? I've got to get the goal, If somebody gets in my way, I can look at you. You don't really care so much about them. The office politics and all that kind of stuff. But you don't really have compassion for the people around you. And because of that, there's all this collateral damage. This is what craving does. Craving leads to the anger. It leads to the not being, to being ruthless, to being inconsiderate towards other beings. That is one of the results of all this craving. So this is how I kind of read the idea of flotsam. I don't know if it's meant to mean that, but that's kind of what to me makes good sense in this particular case. So slow down the stream a little bit is one of the great ways of living here. And the next one is a great answer. Does a strong man might form a lump of spittle on the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty? So true, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle now. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. From none who are born can escape death. Human life is like a lump of spittle, like a lump of spit. I'm going to read dry. It has almost got the top, doesn't it? But that's actually what it happens there. It's spitting out without much difficulty. And then another says, just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly vanish and will not last long. So true, Brahmins, human life is like a piece of meat. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. For none who are born can escape death. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being led to the slaughterhouse, whatever leg she lifts up, she is close to slaughter, close to death. So to Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much misery and much suffering. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. For none who are born can escape death. Right. It's another very powerful simile, the idea of the slaughterhouse. Every time you lift one leg, you are one step closer to death. It's true, isn't it? Especially, of course, for the cow being led to the slaughterhouse, it's very obvious that we are all in the same category, basically. Isn't it? Every time you breathe a breath, you are one breath closer to death. And that is the form of the reality of it. And it draws home this idea. Death is like a slaughterer. Nature comes and kind of reclaims the four elements that you're built up of. And the four elements can no longer serve you. Now they fall apart and they reclaim by nature. And you have to kind of carry on according to your karma. So this is one of the reasons why the suttas are so powerful, because of these kind of similes, and why I find it often so useful, because sometimes this is emotionally, it is much more powerful to read something like that and to say life is impermanent. I'm sure, but when you read this, it kind of really drives it home. Yeah, it really kind of hits you in a much more powerful way with these kind of similes. This is the power of the Buddha's ability. Or are these wonderful symptoms of our life. That was also the point of the sutta yesterday, you know, the seven similes about the sensual pleasures, also very, very powerful to remind us of what is going on. The simile of the thoughts, you know, thought, having a bad thought in the mind is having a carcass of a dead dog slung around your neck. Simple kind of thing, again, very, very powerful and strong. So these similes are very beautiful. This is one of the reasons why I like suttas like this, because they just drive home the reality of these things. Death is around the corner. Death is always a possibility. And allow that to sink in, and it starts to change the way you live as a consequence. And so that is that sutta. And then at the very end here, we have this nice thing that really drives home the point. Yeah. So that's time because the others at the time when life is so short. At that time, the human lifespan was 60,000 years. The girls were marriageable at the age of 500. At that time, people had only six kinds of afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such long lifespans and lived so long, and though their afflictions were so few, still, the teacher Araka gave the disciples such a teaching. Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, for none who are born can escape death. And okay, let us read the very last paragraph of that sutta. Whatever the good should be done by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, seeking the welfare that I have done for you. These are the feet of praise, these are the empty mats. Meditate in this, do not be heedless, do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction. So, there you are, it's only 60,000 years, yeah, life is as short as the top water bubble. Yeah, that's how short it is within 60,000 years. I don't even dare to think how short it is now, but that's a water bubble, but now it's incredibly short by comparison. So, still, this is the teaching it is. So the Buddha is really driving home the point that now is the opportunity. And of course, that is exactly what he says in the very last paragraph there. Now is the opportunity. Whatever should be done by a compassionate teacher, out of compassion, yeah, this is what he has done. He has just told them about this. And now it is up to you to make sure that you make use of this opportunity. You have seen what I'm trying to say. You understand the problem. You understand the urgency of this, yeah? This is like the whole point of this. Drive on the urgency here. I have given you a teaching. Now it is up to you to take it to heart and actually do something out of it. How do you do that? And this is kind of the ideal here. This is the feet of the trees, the empty huts, the sunyagara. Yeah, the feet of the trees, and then kind of stand away and stay in a secluded place, somewhere away from the ordinary things. That's where meditation usually happens, especially if meditation is trying to be deep. And this is one of the reasons why we have retreat centers. Yeah? The more you reflect on that, the more likely you will go to a retreat center down the line there. Because you want to seek out some of those empty huts. This is one of the reasons why in our retreat center in Perth, you get your own room with your own bathroom. Very few retreat centers have that, but we have that in our retreat center, Dharma Grove. And so when you go there, you have a chance to kind of simulate, get close to this ideal there, and you find here with the monks. You're kind of living halfway in the monastic life. When you go to a good retreat center like that, it's in the forest, you have your own room, and you are kind of secluded, at least to some extent, from other people. Coming out of your ordinary circumstances, that gives you a chance to practice this path in a slightly deeper way than what is ordinarily possible. So you prepare yourself by thinking about death. Yeah, by reminding yourself of death, but then one day you get this urge, okay, got to go to the retreat center, got to go and stay at Kodinam Monastery for a couple of weeks just to kind of see what monastic life is like. Yeah. This is what happens. You have been warned. This is the result of thinking about death. You can become more interested in all of these matters, spiritual matters. And don't be heedless, yeah? Not to do your meditation practice, not to do your spiritual practice. That is heedlessness in Buddhism, because you're not seeing things clearly. You're slightly intoxicated by life, and you actually forget to do those things that matter. Do not have cause to regret it later. And when you lie on the deathbed, you think, oh no, I have the opportunity, I didn't catch it. What a waste. And then you kind of don't die all that happened as a consequence. This is our instruction to you. Okay, Aruka Sutta.
Yes, yeah. This Aruka teaches the answer. Second question, but normally I think most people when they reflect on the impermanence of life and so on, they will say, let's enjoy now, because otherwise no time to enjoy conclusion.
Yeah, but that is one conclusion. But even when you come to that conclusion, even then you realize that if you want to really enjoy this life, if you live that really badly, you're not even going to be able to enjoy this life all that much. So even in this present life, if you want to live well, if you want to kind of enjoy, to live in a morally good way is preferable even this very life. If you do all kind of bad things, just feel bad about yourself. And even your food doesn't taste very well, you can feel bad about yourself. But that's one of the nice things it says in the sutta, that if you have come out of a deep state of meditation, afterwards the food tastes much better. this is a good reason to meditate, yeah, because the fruit has better afterwards. So. And so even your general life, you enjoy it more if you live morally well and live in a good life. But of course, that is far, it becomes far more significant once you take into account rebirth, yeah? Then it becomes even far more important again, because then there is this continuity into the future. But even for people who don't believe in rebirth, and you see that in modern society, a lot of people don't have any religion at all anymore, it's spreading around the world very fast. In my own country, over half the population have no religion whatsoever. Over half the population, yeah? Nothing. But even for them, much of it for them actually did quite well. You know, they still believe in kindness, they still believe in ethics. And that has more to do because this life right now is much better lived with an ethical conduct than without it. So, but you are right though, it means that you indulge probably a little bit more than you should be doing it. And you may not take all that indulgence quite as, you know, seriously as you do if you think in longer term. So still, I would agree, it has an effect in the longer term as well. So, yeah. But I also say that if you are a Buddhist, don't still enjoy life, yeah? Don't stop enjoying life just because you're a Buddhist and you think that enjoyment is bad. It's good to enjoy life. Sometimes Buddhists become too serious. Meditate all the time, not enjoy myself at all. And when they become too serious, they just destroy the whole joy of the Buddhist life. So enjoy yourself. Have a bit of fun. Enjoy your food, enjoy a bit of entertainment, you know, but find that balance whereby you can kind of hear a bit of both. But don't become too serious about this life, because if you do, then you have often end up with nothing at all, and life becomes really dry and boring and impossible. So I think it's important, you know, especially if we're going to have more people who are Buddhists, it's important that we kind of give them a path that people are able to practice. The most important thing in our life is our ability to be kind. And if you are able to be kind, and even if you do indulge a bit, it doesn't matter so much. Because that kindness is what in the long run will kind of cause the good states to arise in you. That will enable meditation practice to happen. If you indulge a little bit, it's okay. You enjoy your meals, you enjoy a bit of this, a bit of that, it's fine. It's not going to be a major problem. And then we can find the balance whereby your life actually becomes both enjoyable and wholesome at the same time. And this is the kind of life that people will accept, yeah? I'm not going to get the majority of people to go on the Wenka retreats because it's just too tough, yeah? 10 hours sitting and, so because of that, we need to find a way of living that is more suitable. And I think you can make sometimes better progress by forgetting about those kinds of meditation retreats and actually instead focusing more on how we live our ordinary lives. You can really focus on that, and that actually is also very powerful. Okay. So let's have a quick look at the next little sutta. And then we are ready for tomorrow for the Anapanasati Sutta. I'm not sure why what is it doing here, but because it's here, it might as well be now, so I'm not sure how to go in there. This is what I call Nibbana. And this is how it goes. Then Venerable Ananda approached the Venerable Sariputta and said to him, why is it, friend Sariputta, that some beings do not attain Nibbana in this very life? It's interesting, isn't it? How come you don't attain Nibbana in this very life? Here, friend Ananda, some beings do not understand as it really is. These perceptions lead to deterioration. These perceptions lead to stability. These perceptions lead to improvement or distinction. These perceptions lead to kind of release or penetrating to the truth. This is why some beings here do not attain Nirvana in this very life. Why is it, friend Sariputta, that some beings here do attain Nirvana in this very life? Here, friend Ananda, some beings understand as it really is, or in accordance with reality. These perceptions pertain to or lead to deterioration, to decline.
these perceptions lead to stability, you know, another decline or improvement. These perceptions lead to improvement or distinction. These perceptions pertain to penetration, in other words, to seeing the truth as it actually is. This is why some beings here attain nirvana in this very life. And it's a very interesting sutta. It's interesting because it talks about how to get to nirvana in a certain different way of looking at the whole idea of how to actually reach the end of the Buddhist path. Yeah? This is why there's so interesting about it. Yeah? And all we have to do is to understand perceptions. Yeah? What does perception mean? Perception means how we look at the world. How do you look at things? Yeah? What is your perception right now of being here? What is your perception right now of the people around you? What is the perception now of anything? Yeah, what is the feeling around that? And that perception that you have, either it is a good one that leads you onwards on the path, that leads you toward nirvana, or it is one that goes against nirvana. And if you understand those perceptions that lead to nirvana, of course you will go very fast. And if you understand those that lead away from nirvana, you will go fast. But if you don't understand that, you have a serious problem. You're not going to go anywhere now. And this is one of the reasons why you will have noticed that was a talk after the meditation. I always say, take a little time to review your meditation. Yeah? And what you will see is that there are certain, what you learn after a while, is that there are certain mind states in meditation that actually are conducive to calm, to peace, to allow you to be present at a certain moment, allow you to watch the breath, allow you to have a sense of metta. Yeah, and start to see, start to understand what those things are. And the more you understand that, the more you have the ability to put those things into practice and actually do them accordingly. Yeah. So you understand the perceptions in your mind. You understand when you're looking at the world in a conducive way that actually leads to calm, leads to peace, leads to all the right kind of things. And this is what you learn directly in meditation practice. But it is also the things that I was talking about before. When you look at someone else, you look at another person, and you can see that the perception you have of that person now will lead to anger or ill will. Sometimes you can feel that, yeah? You can feel, the way I'm looking at this person now, I'm going to get angry because I'm seeing all the problems in this person, seeing all the negative traits. And you can see the connection between anger, yeah, and how we are looking at that person. There's a very obvious connection there. Perception gives them rise to the negative mindset arising afterwards. So you see the connection again, and then you have a chance to swap over and to switch your perception. And that was what all those that sutta I was talking about before. Remember the five ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. The very first one was just to change your object. Yeah? You look at the person in one way, you change the way you look at that person. You look at the good qualities, you look at something else, you have compassion for them. Whatever it is, you look at it in such a way that it changes that thing. And this is what it means. You know which perceptions are useful, so you use those useful perceptions. Then you will kind of have the ability to move towards nirvana very quickly. It takes a lot of mindfulness, yeah, because you have to be aware of what's happening in your mind. And very often, we don't have enough mindfulness to see clearly enough. But the more mindfulness you have, the more ability you have to make these shifts in perception. First of all, you understand which ones are useful, which ones are bad. Then that enables you to shift at the right time, to look at things in a new way. Go away from the bad ones, move towards the good ones instead, and then you go towards nirvana. So what's a beautiful way of thinking about nirvana, yeah? All you have to understand is the right kind of perceptions in life. And the last one there, the perceptions that lead to understanding the truth, yeah, penetrating the truth, going through to see things as they really are. And that is the very highest status on the path, when you become a screen actor or what it is, yeah? That's when you have that insight into reality, seeing things as they actually are. So you need to know which perceptions it is that lead to that sort of insight. Yeah, and these are the perceptions of looking at the five khandhas in terms of the three characteristics. That is the kind of perception we're talking about there. So you reflect on your experience, you look back in that way, you see it, and then you can have this opportunity to make a complete breakthrough to nirvana itself, to become a sphere mentor or whatever else it is. So very, kind of very interesting, I find this kind of a very interesting thing. So it's just a different way of looking at things.
So we can focus on what perceptions are useful and which ones are bad. That can take a long way on the path. Okay, any questions, any more comments, anything anyone would like to say then? Anyone okay? Yes, sir.
You were talking about the presence and then as well as the middle verse in one balance in the monastery around the Sutta Bali, that is the Buddha, the Sutta, and we talk about Nibbana as something which is no calling, no going, no
time
for that.
Yeah.
So, how can it relate to the presence that we are looking at in this Sutta?
Yes, the Bali is showing us coming, not being reborn, not realizing that. How that led to impermanence. I'm not sure if it relates directly. I think more the idea there is just more that once you attain Nibbana, that's it, you know, everything, you actually feel it's not kind of the mind doesn't move anymore, and you don't have to go anywhere as a consequence. So I don't know if it has any direct relationship to impermanence as such. I think that is more about the result of the practice. This here is more about the actual path, and is more to do with the result. So you can argue, you can maybe say that, you know, if you contemplate impermanence, you kind of, you reach permanence. Then, you know, all things is kind of a permanent state, you know, like maybe you can trip that way. But. Okay, very good. So let's stop there and see you back here again at 6 o'clock this morning.